You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 153.
This is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that was a little teaser, some new age piano, which is one of my favorite kinds of music. It's called Lines Build Walls by Aaron Starks. And as usual, I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. My topic today is an interview with Dr. Ken Hartman. He's the CEO of DegreeQuest and the past president of Drexel University Online. I've known Ken for a long time. Our paths have crossed many times since he was at Drexel for a number of years. In fact, I helped him when he founded the National Distance Learning Week a number of years ago. I interviewed Ken before, I guess it was about 4 years ago, but certainly a lot has changed since then. So I decided to get an update from Ken on what he's been doing for the past couple of years and get his take on what's happening in higher ed, especially online learning. Ken has a long distinguished history in education, especially online. In fact, this talk highlights changes to teaching learning over the last 20 years. When Ken published his book, The Internet Guide for College-Bound Students, he published that in 1996. So certainly a lot has happened since then, and a lot has happened since we talked about 4 years ago. We talk about the unsustainable rise in college tuition, what colleges can do about that, how important the use of big data is, future of the LMS, disruptive innovation in education, the role of AI and VR in e-learning, faculty development, the importance of data analytics, and many more topics. So it was a wide-ranging discussion, but I think you'll find it interesting. So without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Ken Hartman. Ken, thanks so much for agreeing to talk to me again. It's been about 4 years since we talked last.
Wow.
At least on the podcast.
Well, the good news is that, you know, nothing has really changed in higher education the last 4 years. So it's not like we missed anything, right?
Really? Well, you know, it's funny because I listened to the last podcast and, you know, a lot of things you talked about then have come true and are coming true. You know, some schools are going out of business or merging or, as we saw, buying for-profits and everything else. So I know you've been in this business for a long time. Why don't you give my audience just a brief background on how you got into all this?
Well, yeah, it's actually, I think it's coming up on 40 years. And like many of us, I came up through the ranks, you know, assistant professor, associate professor, had a couple stop outs along the way, including 11 years with the College Board. That was a wonderful. And then going back in the higher education, eventually, and up until recently, was at Drexel University, where I was president of Drexel University Online. I was there for 9 years. And helped to grow that online program to one of the largest, and I'd argue probably one of the most successful programs out there, with over 100 degrees and 8,000 students. Left Drexel and became a senior fellow with Edge Ventures, and then recently, in the last 6 months, have taken over the role of CEO in a turnaround in a company called DegreeQuest, which helps adult learners who have courses and work experience in a variety of different settings and institutions to pull that together to find out which college will give them the most amount of credit for that prior experience. So I've kind of seen it in all different directions. And along the way, as you know, have written my fair share of books and articles, and have been just absolutely amazed to see where we are now versus where we were even, you know, 4 months ago in higher education.
That's right. I think some of this was documented in an article that appeared, what, 20 years ago that you wrote?
Well, 20 years ago this month in June, USA Today did a half-page story on a book that I wrote at the time 20 years ago called The Internet Guide for College-Bound Students. At that time, if most people were using a 28.8 baud modem and I was writing books and articles about how this crazy thing called the internet was going to fundamentally change the way students viewed schools, selected schools, the way that we teach, the way that we learn. And everybody at that point in time thought I was absolutely crazy and up the crazy tree, because who would ever want to listen to this squeaky thing called a modem? Well, in fact, there was one chapter called The World Wide Web. I think maybe 40 to 50 colleges had websites at that point in time. But as we know, it wasn't about the squeaky noise called a modem. It was about this ability to deliver information in ways that we could never do it. And today, almost like companies such as Kodak, who didn't see the digital film business coming, you still see higher ed institutions that haven't quite figured out how to deal with the digital learning changes, and they're suffering some of the same consequences. So yeah, 20 years went really, really fast. And I think the next 20 years are going to go even faster. As you know, the technology is going to change, and the information that we will have at our disposal will be mind-boggling.
Yeah, certainly everything seems to be accelerating when it comes to technology. I mean, it seems like they're having breakthroughs every time you turn around. I also remind our audience, and I'll have links to it. You've also written, I think, some seminal articles where you use the metaphor of the education highway and what institutions have to do to prevent going out of business.
Yeah, you know, in the first, I think it was a 4-part series. The first piece gave colleges a matrix by which to score themselves to see where they were along the highway. Are they approaching exit 1 or exit 5? After exit 5, the bridge is out. But, you know, I decided after the first one that I was done talking about the problem. I've been talking about it for 20 years. I'm now focusing my writing and my conversations around what the solutions are, because I think everybody's finally woken up to the problem. We can't do business as usual. Oh, sure, the top 100 colleges will be able to get away with what they're doing right now, because there'll always be a market. For the vast majority of institutions, they've got to offer a different product, if you will, in a different way at a different price point. And that's going to come hard to many of them.
Is it just the smaller private institutions that are most at risk?
No, I think you're seeing all institutions are struggling right now, because the traditional funding mechanisms, be it alums or going to the bank and asking for a capital, is becoming increasingly more difficult to generate. And of course, while the stock market has skyrocketed over the last few years, household income has not. And so price sensitivity for tuition and so forth is going to continue to be where it's at. And, you know, what we're seeing now is that colleges who have been going through this discounting, or what I like to refer to as the higher ed Ponzi scheme of robbing Peter to pay Paul, that is no longer effective anymore. So they have to come up with a new way of delivering and pricing the programs and the courses that they offer.
That's right. Yeah, I a lot of schools, one very close to me, is revamping how they handle discounting. I'm sure everybody's going to be doing that.
And when you throw on top of that other external circumstances like unfunded pension and retirement funds, healthcare, and other things, all these external pressures, not just on higher education, but on states to fund other things like prisons and K-12, you know, we're going to see a lot more change, particularly, I believe, at the smaller state universities than we will perhaps at some of the smaller private ones that have less internal regulatory issues they've got to deal with than, say, you know, a Shippensburg, for example.
I think you would agree, and more and more people are agreeing, that education is ripe for disruption. You mentioned your connection, you're being CEO of DegreeQuest, and I know you just came back from ASU GSV. I was wondering if you can give me a quick summary of some of the disruptive things you've been learning about recently.
this was a seventh or eighth year of ASU GSV. I attended the first one, and I haven't been back since. And what a difference. When I first went to the conference, there were mostly investors, bankers, private equity people, and a handful of companies that were in the e-learning space and education space, K-12 and higher education. Fast forward to 2 weeks ago, 3,000 people in Salt Lake City, 700 companies. And gosh, you couldn't walk 5 inches without running into a private equity person looking to talk with an entrepreneur about capital needs to advance whatever product or service they were offering. And some of those products and services were truly, truly remarkable. I mean, everything from online calculators with all sorts of bells and whistles. I mean, you can't begin to describe the opportunities that these companies are offering. The challenge they have, of course, is that gaining access and entrance to colleges and universities who are oftentimes difficult to get into. So these companies are have tremendous opportunities to help students to learn and help faculty and others to teach more effectively. It's just a question of getting them noticed and getting them to the college's attention.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because pharmaceutical companies are pushing right to the end user on TV. I think we're going to see more of this where these new innovations are going to be pushed to the students themselves and sort of let it bubble up from the grassroots level.
That's a great question, and I don't really know. I mean, higher ed, as you know very well, is a very unique governance structure. Decisions on purchasing decisions are often made by committee. They're slow, as opposed to a doctor in an office that could hand you a free sample and say, try this, and if it works, I'll write you a script. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see that. You're certainly seeing that a little bit more now in the way that student loans are being packaged to deal with debt. I guess only time will tell if that's an effective or actually anybody tries to market directly that way.
I think there'll be more models, pricing models available from some companies. The one that comes to mind initially is Turning Point. I mean, we have the students buy their own licenses, and there are other similar products that, you know, maybe a school decides that, well, not everybody in the university needs it. Maybe we'll leave it up to the department or the college, or just, you know, add that to the list of expenses that the students have to pay for directly.
Yeah, I see that. My daughter's in an accelerated nursing program, and I see a lot of textbooks and other tools that she has for her classes. The faculty member is simply saying, take a credit card and go on and purchase a subscription for a year. So, you know, that brings up a whole host of other questions about use of student data, to what extent that information is archived. You know, you see a lot of these companies come and go, and that information has to somehow work, as you know, very closely and in sync with the learning management system. So it's not without its problems, but if that's the only way that a faculty member can get something that's of value to their students, then I think we're going to see more of that.
You mentioned the learning management system. We happen to be going through the process of deciding, to continue our existing arrangement or look for another LMS. Is the LMS going here to stay, or is that something that's already kind of dated and that people schools are going to be doing without an LMS? What's your thoughts on that?
Higher ed has never been accused of moving quickly, has never been accused of being a change agent. So whenever an LMS is in place, faculty don't like to give up what they know for what they don't know. So I think that the Blackboards of the world will find that their market share will gradually erode as the big players such as Google and others get more and more into this market, into this space. So they can't sit there and rest on their laurels at all. So I think there will definitely be some shifting, and there'll be newer players that will take a larger share of the marketplace. But it's going to happen over the course of 5 to 7 years. I don't think we're going to see any big player come on. Grab 20% market share away from a Blackboard, for example.
If anybody does, I think Google has a chance. I mean, we're already a Google Apps for Education school, or now G Suite. It certainly doesn't have the functionality of an LMS, but just look what's happened in K-12. I mean, it used to be Apple was the big player in education, and they've just really just lost that. And apparently, I don't know, I don't have the statistics top of my head, but Google and their very cheap laptops are coming into schools all over the place.
Right. And so that gets back to certainly the disruptive innovation theory, and will one or two of those companies come in there and topple the big guns? Unlikely, because the big guns have so much money. But certainly, based on what I heard at ASU GSV from the Blackboard officials, they're not sitting back and waiting for that to happen. They're being very aggressive in their outreach, and where necessary to make acquisitions to stay competitive.
What do you see from your experience at ASU GSV? Is there anything that really stood out as being disruptive? I mean, we pretty much know about the LMSs and the Starfish and some of the other applications that we use here on campus. Anything come to mind that was surprising or really new?
I think we need to keep an eye on artificial intelligence, AI, and virtual reality. I saw a lot of fascinating companies that were doing things with AI. We are, as you know, as a society, giving away tons of data on what we do, who we are, how we think, etc., whether it be to one of these Alexa, right? We have one in our home. I turned it off as soon as I got it. You're seeing this massive amount of data, and I think AI is going to play a huge role in everything from how students select a college to how students select an instructor, who virtual academic advisors, virtual tutors. We are feeding so much information from a very early age into these devices and into these databases that they're going to know everything about our particular learning style, our learning methods, and will be able to guide us through and guide students through so much of that process. So I think certainly AI and to a lesser extent virtual reality, you saw a lot of the headgear that's being used. I'm not quite sure whether that's going to really take root in a lot of areas. But then again, some of the companies that are doing virtual reality in the sciences and the ability to see 3D mapping and along with improvements in printers that we're seeing and the prices of those coming down, I think we're going to see a lot more in those three areas. At least I saw that when I was listening to the 700 companies that were there. But again, big data is not going anywhere, and we're going to see interesting companies come forward in their use of that data.
That's right. Every time I get a chance, I love to talk about AR and VR and AI. I've been I read up on that as much as I can. Not too long ago, a bunch of us, in fact, it was our Padlet group, visited what looks like the holodeck at Villanova. You walk into this room that has floor, the three sides, and the roof are all projection video. And they spent millions of dollars on this. They had a grant. But now you don't even need that. All you need to put on is to put on some headgear, and you can have several people in a virtual space interacting with each other. And the implications, I think, for education is just tremendous. It's liable to be expensive at first, but it keeps coming down. In fact, I'm told that Google's coming out promising a headgear that's going to rival something that's like Oculus, which is expensive and it still has to be tethered to a laptop PC. They're going to have something standalone, doesn't even use your cell phone, that is going to enable some of this technology. So I think Google seems to be at the forefront, especially when it comes to AI. They've had some major, major advances just in the past year or two. And I don't think people quite realize what's possible with some of their technology these days.
One of the feature speakers at ASU GSV was the gentleman who created and leads the virtual reality lab at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And he showed multiple examples in this lab, this multi-million dollar lab that he built in Silicon Valley with the support of many of the technology companies out there. But in one case, it's a teacher who's sitting in a classroom, and they're able to simulate multiple student interactions and disciplinary issues, as you can see unfold in front of you, in the same way that a pilot can go into a virtual flight deck and be bombarded with multiple scenarios, weather and so forth, to negotiate that. They're moving that thinking, that technology, in so many ways, whether it's in an operating room or whether it's in a classroom. Now, it's very, very expensive to replicate that. But as you said, the technology is going to become cheaper, it's going to become smaller, it's going to be more readily available. And maybe it comes down to the fact that everybody, you know, we saw a time where colleges were quick to require everybody to buy a laptop. So maybe you'll see colleges will require everybody to buy a headset that they can use all 4 years when school. Who knows? But it is coming, and I think it shows great promise for learning.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that's coming down the pike supposedly is Apple. You know, they haven't introduced anything really, really new other than, you know, incremental improvements in the iPhone and the iPad. But I don't know, I've heard some people say that they're about to come out with blockbuster technology for education coming this as early as this fall. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. That may be the new iPad, and it's likely to be virtual or most likely augmented reality, which is a little bit easier to do.
Well, you know, what everybody realizes and everybody knows is that these edtech companies, with the stock market being as high as it is, they're flooded with cash. And their shareholders at Apple and Google and other places are saying, spend that money. So they have a ton of capital, a ton of money that they have to spend. They can't sit on it. So when you've got that much money, because the stock market has done so well for you, then you're going to be able to put dollars in places that you wouldn't able to do that in the past. And like I said, we're going to see breakthroughs in medicine, breakthroughs in teaching, in ways that we can't even imagine right now.
What advice you would give, let's say a small private institution just got a donation, you know, one of their donors, gave them $1 million. What do you think they should do with it?
I think they should hire a good data analytics expert and begin looking at the data that they have currently right now so they can get a baseline of student performance and be able to demonstrate the effect of their courses and degrees on their graduates, show a baseline coming in and where they came when they go out. I think it's going to be critical for institutions to be able to demonstrate added value. Again, if you're going to one of the top, you know, Nifty 50 or top 100 institutions, the brand will carry you. But for the vast majority of the colleges going forward, they're going to have to demonstrate to future students and employers that there was something there. So big data is here. There's an opportunity not only to get someone who understands how to manipulate that, but some of the software, some of the hardware that can be incorporated into the individual classrooms that will allow instructors to assess impact and engagement. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what a college has to offer is not an athletic program. It is an academic experience. And I think we in higher ed have to do a much better job in demonstrating that that experience is worth the price. I believe it is, but a lot of people are struggling right now financially. So we've got to be able to demonstrate that. And I think we have a unique opportunity with the technology and the data and some of the software partners that are out there right now to really be able to hone in on that. Forget about building another Taj Mahal dormitory. Forget about building a rec center that you think is going to lure in prospective students. At the end of the day, that's not what they want. It's about the educational experience. And I think if they open their eyes up and look around, there are opportunities out there to really advance learning and advance teaching.
Well, that sounds like certainly good advice. So how about online? Do you think that every school needs to have online programs, needs to have that choice for students?
No. I think that we are seeing as recently as just the other day, Inside Higher Education published a report, EduVentures and Quality just published a report showing that enrollment in online programs and online students is fairly flat. And in fact, it's down at the community colleges. There's no shortage of online degrees and programs out there. I think where colleges who are in the online world need to demonstrate that their courses that are offered online are as good as, if not better than, the outcomes that you get face to face. I think too many institutions see it as just a glorified correspondence course. I've seen it time and time again. And I believe going forward, certainly in the next couple of years, you're going to start to see an increased attention by both federal and state lawmakers on the extent of engagement that is in fact occurring in these online courses. Are students truly engaged in ways that the regulations require them to do that? I think for a lot of colleges, they've kind of gotten away with that. I think those days are ending, and there's going to be a much, much more scrutiny on what goes on in online. But the good news is this is an opportunity for you to improve what you offer online and improve engagement, improve learning, and be able to demonstrate that. So, you know, again, I there's no shortages of colleges offering it. It all comes down, thankfully, to one word, and that is quality.
Quality, absolutely.
And that's a good thing.
I think one of the hardest jobs that we have here, at least in my department, is faculty development. I mean, you can't just give tenured faculty, offer them workshops. They either don't come or you know, they're resistant in changing their ways. And I think there are certainly certifications out there. As you know, I guess what you need to do is give faculty release time and encourage them with the, you know, promotion tenure to improve their quality.
We both have been in this field for a long, long time, and we all know that the teaching in the classroom, in many cases, if it's of quality nature, it's simply by chance, because nobody who's ever got a PhD or an EdD or any other doctorate for that matter has ever gone through as part of their preparation period how to teach. I mean, you teach the way you were taught.
Exactly.
And if you've never been taught online, and there's some really good people that teach online, there's some really bad people, no different than face-to-face, you're apt to simply repeat that which you experienced. And again, I think in this day and age, that's not going to cut it. I mean, you could get away with that when your tuition was such that, you know, mom and dad didn't have to reach into their 401k or take a second mortgage on their home to pay for your tuition. You could go away and, quote, find yourself. But ever since we went beyond that threshold, and now we have staggering 1.4, I believe, amount of student debt, and that isn't even talking about parental debt, I think the public now is demanding more. So I would say, how do you get faculty to do that? It comes down to leadership. It comes down to leadership at a department level, at a college level, and certainly at the university level, where deans and provosts and presidents have to exert both a carrot and a stick approach to making it happen. Because if they don't, we're always going to get what we've always got, and that's not good enough, I don't think, going forward.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. This has been a wide-ranging, but I think stimulating conversation, and I think my listeners will enjoy it. I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to me and bring us up to speed.
Brad, it's always a pleasure, and let's not wait another 4 years before we meet again. But thank you.
Sounds good. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Ken Hartman. Don't forget to check out the links to some of the things we talked about on my show notes. And stay tuned for the New Age Piano piece, Lines Build Walls. So until next time, have a great week. Thanks for listening.
it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.